This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and joining me once again this week is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, the year is in full swing. I just put a new Ready Room out yesterday. We had a new Warp 5 last week. We've got a new Orb. We had a new Literary Treks. We're finally really talking Trek again this year.
Yeah, it's exciting to be doing that, and I mean, Chris, for us, it is the 47th episode of Literary Treks.
That's right.
And we are going to...
The magic number.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It really is. So it's great to be celebrating that with you. It's great to be back on Literary Treks, as you said, and hitting full swing, and we're finishing the fall today. So another great milestone as well for this episode. So I can't imagine a better place to be here then on a Wednesday for me evening talking Star Trek books and comics with you, and then of course being joined by our guest Dayton Ward. So it is a huge show, and yeah, really excited to be here. So how yeah. Things been going for you there in Japan?
Oh, it's busy, and you know, so much stuff happening with the network, and then you know, the kids back in school. Everything's going, you know, we often talk about weather here on the show. You might find this funny. Japan is an extremely low crime country. So our news is not about how many murders happened or robberies or the kinds of things
that exciting.
You know, well, but you might find this exciting because we have very little crime to report. Our reporters have time to go out and do other things, and they have airtime to talk about them. So it's been very, very cold here. And apparently yesterday morning, the theme of the morning news was, it's cold in Japan, and it's snowing. Let's go out and film frozen tofu and bananas and punch holes in ice. And that's what we had yesterday morning.
I don't really think I can imagine a more exciting events than right? Frozen tofu and ice.
Frozen tofu. Yes.
Yeah, that is quality television right there.
it really was.
So, I mean, I think Japan may have some of the strangest television shows on. So that's probably a really small thing there. So that's really funny though.
Well, you know, frozen tofu, I think, is a great transition to the one item that we have in news today, and that's about Star Trek Voyager Protectors, which is finally going to be dropping here on January 28th. And I say it's a good transition because I think Neelix could probably take frozen tofu and really turn it into something special.
Yeah, you know, I think he could as well. I got to love myself some Neelix. Who knows if he'll be showing up in Protectors. But exciting to me, honestly, that Voyager is going to be back in the books. You know, I think any fan that knows Trek FM knows that Voyager is not my favorite series. But in Kirsten Beyer's hands, Voyager has become one of my favorite book series. And so I'm really excited to be getting this back. And what she's done with the characters in this series is, I think, made it everything that it could have been as a series in general. And so I cannot wait to be getting back into some Voyager. And then, of course, talking to Kirsten sometime probably in early February. So this is fantastic. I'm really glad to be having this back. Some big things are going to be happening here as the fleet is going to be looking at a distress call that it could not answer 9 years ago. And, of course, Admiral Janeway has to go and face the music now that she's back from the dead. with Admiral Akkar, who has just played a huge role in The Fall. And so this is going to be a really, really great book, I think. I'm really excited to be picking this up on the 28th.
How does that go? You go back to Starfleet Command, you sit down for this evaluation period that she has to go through. You sit down and you're asked, Kathy, where the hell have you been? And she says, I've been dead. I'm sorry I couldn't contact you. How does that play out?
I don't know. That's tough. What do you say? I was dead and now I'm alive.
just short
I'm
and sweet.
I'm a little bit like Jesus. I mean,
these are the facts.
Yeah. That's a tough thing to say. I don't really know how that goes down at Starfleet. Although, you know, maybe she should ask Ambassador Spock. How did that go for you when you were like, hey, I'm dead and now I'm alive again. Can I have my, you know, old job back on the Enterprise? Is that cool? So at least they have, I mean, who would have known that Admiral Janeway and Spock were going to have so much in common?
I didn't see it coming, but, you know, that's why the literary universe is so great, right?
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, I am looking forward to talking to Kirsten about this and, yeah, just hearing, you know, how the book came together and all. So that will be coming up here on the show.
Definitely.
Like you said, probably in February sometime.
Yeah, that should be really exciting, Chris, to be having Kirsten back on the show. I love it when she's on. And, I really do enjoy these Voyager books. And for a series that I was not a huge fan of when it was on, I gotta say, these characters do come alive in her hands. And so I'm really looking forward to being back in the 24th century as we've been in with The Fall. But seeing what's going on with Chakotay, with Coco and Kathy and the rest of the gang.
And that beam of light that's apparently the monkey, at least that's what the beam of light that's on the cover.
Exactly. Hey, you know, maybe instead of calling it, Star Trek Voyager books, maybe when we talk to Margaret, we could maybe get that called Coco and Kathy and Family, or, you know, Coco, Kathy and the Gang. Doesn't that sound like a really good band name?
It does. It would work great as a band. Or we could do like the Joni Loves Chachi. We could have, you know, Kathy Loves Coco.
There you go. See, there that yeah. I think we've got the brand new series. If they actually just want to do a spinoff of Voyager, it could be, you know, Kathy Loves Coco.
Yeah, I like it. All right. Well, you mentioned The Fall. And of course, today, as you said, we're going to have Dayton on with us to talk about the final book in The Fall series. It's great that we will now have a complete set of interviews for you to listen to, all five authors from The Fall. Before we jump into that, well, this is the only item we have in news today. The bulk of the show is going to be the interview with Dayton. Before we do bring Dayton on, though, we do want to tell you about our sponsor for today's show. And our sponsor is Audible.com. They help us bring literary treks to you every week. And as many of you already know, they are the premier source for audiobooks online. They have more than 150,000 titles to choose from, both current bestsellers and classic titles as well. Just about any category, any genre you can imagine. They have a lot of Star Trek books on there. Some of my favorites, like Prime Directive, Federation, Spock's World, Shadows on the Sun, which we talked about here on the show quite some time ago, Great McCoy Story. And we want to recommend a book to you each week here on the show. And the one I want to recommend today is one that I've just started listening to recently. And it is The Physics of Star Trek by Lawrence Krauss. And I read it when it very first came out in hardcover in the 1990s. And it was a really interesting book at that time because the technology that's being written about was what we had in our hands at the time. And Krauss is extrapolating based on the technology that we had in the 1990s. What would it take for us to get to those technologies that we see on the show? You know, transporters, for example. I remember, so Matthew, think back to your computer that you had in the 1990s. How big was the hard drive on your computer?
Oh, goodness. I'm trying to think. I don't know, in the megabytes at least, I feel like.
Right, yeah, you know. Something like that. Like, I remember buying my memory's fading now, but I can remember in like 1996 buying, I want to say it was a 4 gigabyte hard drive. And I remember it costing like $350 or $400. It was just incredible. But he has this part in the book where he talks about using the largest hard drives that we had at that time, how many you would have to stack on top of each other to hold the pattern of one person if you wanted to transport that person. Right. And it stacked like all the way to the moon, from the surface of the earth to the moon.
Oh, gosh.
But I read it back then, and I had been wanting it in audio format for quite some time, but it was really, for some reason, like when you join Audible, when you're a member, you get credits, and you can either pay for books with a dollar amount, or you can just use a credit. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, this book was always 2 credits. I don't know why. And so finally, they have reduced it to 1 credit, and so then I picked it up. And it's a really interesting book, and even though it's dated technologically, it's still really fun to listen to, because you know what kind of technology we have now.
Right.
And many of you listening to the show, you know, you were using computers in the 90s and you were buying hardware. And so you can kind of get your mind around, you know, how technology has advanced now. So it's still very, very interesting, both for nostalgic purposes, as well as looking forward to the future. You know, how are we going to get to that Star Trek technology?
Yeah, that's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's a really fun book. And Krauss is a professor of physics and astronomy at the Case Western Reserve University. You've probably seen him. If you watch television shows, he pops up a lot on these, like Discover Channel, History Channel, when they do things related to science. He pops up on a lot of different shows as a guest speaker. So you've probably seen him before. The book is narrated by Larry McKeever, and you can get this book absolutely free just for trying Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/trekafilm and sign up, you can get a free audiobook of your choice. So it could be The Physics of Star Trek, it could be another one of your favorite Star Trek books, or a current release, new release, bestseller that you want to read that you don't have time to sit down with, but you could listen to it on your headphones just like you do podcasts as you're commuting to work or exercising or cleaning the house, whatever you do. And by doing that, you'll also be helping us bring literary treks to you every week. So again, go over to audibletrial.com/trekafilm. There's nothing to lose. If you choose not to stick with Audible after your trial, you still get to keep that free audiobook. That's yours. So go try it out today. And we really thank Audible for supporting Literary Treks and the network. And of course, you for supporting Audible.
Well, Chris, we are really excited to have back with us our very first guest for Literary Treks. So episode 1 was Dayton Ward. Was super excited to have him on, and Dayton Ward also gets the privilege of being our guest for the 47th episode of Literary Treks. Can you believe we made it, Chris?
That's right, 47.
So, Peaceable Kingdoms is what we're going to be talking about tonight, and everybody knows this is the final novel of the electrifying Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek The Next Generation crossover event in the 24th century.
Star Trek Titan, don't forget Titan.
Exactly. You know, we've got all of them out there. Typhon Pack, it's all here. And this is racing towards the resolution. You know, James just left us on the edge of our seat and waiting for Dayton to pick up all the pieces that have been strewn all over the floor, kind of like when you're playing with Legos, and to put it all back together into some semblance of order. And so, Dayton, welcome back to the show.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you.
All right, Dayton. So the first thing I'm thinking when I'm reading the book is this. Is, okay, we've had everybody, you know, in the order and they've written their books. How did you get chosen to clean this whole mess up? I mean, everybody else gets to like pull all the pieces out. And did you want to clean up? Did you want to the back clean up here, or was that where like, oh, we're going to get Dayton because we know he can do this?
I think it was a function of I was late to the meeting and all the other stuff had been called or taken or, you know, dibs. I don't really remember why I was the one chosen to bat cleanup. I know, other than the fact that I think Margaret, our editor, wanted Picard and the Enterprise E to factor into the final the final installment, and she had already tapped me to write that story. So I think that's how the pieces kind of got arranged. I mean, I think David George setting it all, I mean, obviously what happens on DS9 in the first book, that was, you know, a foregone conclusion that he was going to write that.
Right.
And Una McCormick expressed an interest in writing a Garrick Picard tale.
Oh, she loves Garrick.
Yes, she does. And then, you know, of course, the pieces start to get moved around the board a lot in David Mack's book, with the Andor problem taking, you know, front, you know, center stage. And Bashir and Dax playing a role, and then Jim comes in with, you know, Riker and the Titan crew to mix things up a little bit, and then it's just, you know, here, Dayton, here's all the things we've put together for four books. See what you can do with that. You know, it wasn't quite that bad. I mean, we all talked about who was going to do what and which events were going to happen in what book, and you know, if you've read all five books, you know that some events take place in and around each other.
Yes.
Even though they take place in different books, they take place simultaneously within this 60-day window. So that was the challenging part, was coordinating all these things that had to happen in this very brief span of time, you know, in continuity, and let everybody have a piece of the pie, you know, get to play a little bit as far as the big story, and then, of course, tell a tale, you know, of their own in and around all of those other requirements. So, you know, it was a lot of fun, but it was a lot of work. We had this massive spreadsheet that we put back and forth, you know, that had a timeline from, you know, laid out day by day in the 60-day window about what happened in at this point, this character and this ship and, you know, these events that get picked up from one book to the next. So, and that thing got sent around several times.
When you got that spreadsheet, was it just a little bit easier for you at all? Because you kind of had all the events laid out, and so you're just kind of picking all the pieces back up and placing them then where you want them to be finished, and I guess where Margaret is trying to get you to be for, you know, what's going to come next?
Yeah. Actually, now that I think about it, one of the reasons why I ended up being last is because I was writing another book at the time all this was being laid out. I was finishing up From History Shadow, the TOS book that I wrote that came out earlier this year.
Oh, yes, excellent book.
At the same time, okay.
So by the time I got Peaceable Kingdoms, you know, everybody else was either finishing up their book or well underway with their book. And so the spreadsheet was an enormous help for me to get, you know, give me a quick look at major events or, you know, where this character was going to be or if I was going to make a reference to that event or whatever. I was able to catch up pretty quick because I had a very quick and steep learning curve to be able to get,
right,
you know, start writing on this one.
Well, and okay, so we are at the end of the fall, and I mean, how in the world then do you take all those pieces and kind of wrap up this massive space opera that, you know, the four other writers have created for you and try and put the universe back into some semblance of order?
Well, I mean, in some respects, you know, my four colleagues did a fine job of laying the pieces out in a logical order that I could, you know, very naturally pick up the, you know, and run with. Jim Swallow in particular, you know, he and I spent one afternoon talking on Skype for probably two and a half hours working out different story points, things that I could, you know, take from his story and carry forward in addition to things I was already plotting, so that I could tie, you know, if my book ties in closely with any of them, it'll be Jim's.
Right.
The Poison Chalice. And so, you know, because there's even a sequence where I use a message that Riker sends to Picard at the end of Jim's book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the enemy hides in plain sight, and I pick up that transition in my book later on. So it was a lot of fun working on all the pieces. I mean, like I said, they all did a great job with their individual stories and leaving, you know, the plot threads for me to pick up and go with and tie it all into a nice little – I hope I tied it into a nice little bow. You know, the readers get to decide if we did it or not. So I still had room to tell my own take, you know, my own story as far as the secret of the temporary president, Ishan Anjar, and what his dark secret is, and involve the Enterprise crew, especially Beverly Crusher.
Yes.
Thought, you know, she hadn't really gotten a starring role in any of these stories for a while, so it was kind of fun to change up things.
So on Ishan, is that something where you knew the backstory going in, or did you just get to create that really as being like, this is the thing that Dayton gets to run with?
I actually came up with the idea that he would be in a, you know, his, what his, I don't, I hate to spoil, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but.
Spoilers, as far as his everyone. Secret,
I actually, should we actually talk about it or should we?
Yeah,
we can talk about it.
Fine.
I think
we'll
it's good
it.
To, because a lot of people listening have read it and then they want to hear the behind the scenes story. Yeah.
Warning. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Yeah, advance the file right. 1 minute and 10 seconds from this point. I came up with the idea of him being an imposter. And, of course, we tossed around the idea of what kind of imposter he would be, whether he would be somebody that was a surgically altered Cardassian, or would he be a changeling, or and I came up with the idea that he had swapped identities with another Bajoran during the occupation. So once I figured out that that was going to be his backstory, then it was a simple matter for the for David and Una and David again and Jim to go back into their manuscripts and just tweak it enough so that they could leave me the room to come up with that revelation without it seeming like it came out of left field. Because like I said, at that point, by the time I was figuring out what was going on, they were already well underway with their different manuscripts. So. I was trying to come up with a story there where it would all tie together, but yet not require them to go back and make massive rewrites to support what I was setting up or what I was coming up with. So, but luckily, you know, the references to Ishan in the other books, you know, you don't really see his point of view largely in any of these other scenes. You know, most of the time when you see Ishan, he's referenced from someone else's point of view. So it was easy to hide things like that, like his internal, his internal dialogue, his internal monologue, and thoughts. So, but everybody was on board with that. Apparently it was a relatively painless fix. Nobody threw a fit or tried to kill me or have me killed or anything like that. So,
that's good.
So it was fun. I came up with that idea, and then Jim Swallow helped me work out some of the logistics to make that idea, you know, make sense. You know, we talked about what he would do during the occupation and how he would hide himself and how he would obscure his real identity and things like that. So, and of course tie into what he had already revealed in his book with, you know, Velk, you know, today being the main guy in this, all of this. So we had to make it all make sense. So it was, like I said, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work, a lot of coordination and back and forth and give and take and on the part of all five of us to make it all work.
Yeah, it's a very cool process.
This is something I've mentioned to every single author, but I mean, I've read a lot of tie-in fiction in my day and read a lot of different universes as well, and I've read multi-author collections or storylines, and this one, I think, for me, is probably the most seamless that I've ever read, and to have five different authors write a series and have it come off this well is really difficult, and you guys just did such a great job, and that's just not me, like, you know, kissing up. I mean, I've read in different universes, and I've seen this done before a lot of times, and just the way that this story fits together is seamless, and I love that, and it probably has to do with, you know, David Mack creating this huge spreadsheet for you guys, and you guys working so well together. But I love the way the story comes together, and I'm hard pressed to find any areas where I was like, I don't really see how that fits together, and that's fantastic. I mean, that's what you want from a series, you know, like your favorite TV show, is to have all that fit together. So well done, you guys.
Well, on behalf of my colleagues, I'll say thank you. And if there are mistakes, especially in the last book, you know, then I have to own them solely, you know, because it's not like they didn't lay out a blueprint for me to follow. So, I mean, we all had conversations about it and we all contributed to it. But, you know, by the time I was writing the second half of my book, everybody else was pretty much done and moved on to other things. So, so any mistakes in that regard are mine. But, the spreadsheet definitely was a big help. And it's just massive. It's ridiculous with the notes involved, even the little things, you know. I work on things for my day job that aren't this complicated. And it's not one of those things you want to do it for every project, but something like this, it almost demands that level of coordination and back and forth. But yeah, it's I think we're going to take a break from these sorts of gigantic super crossover miniseries things for a bit.
Yeah. Well, I think too, what you just said is really key. You know, it doesn't require it for every story, but when it does, it paid off beautifully. And so your guys' hard work really paid off. I mean, so many of the books in the series turned into New York Times bestsellers. And I think that goes to show the quality of the story, the quality of the writing. And so obviously I think, you know, we have to thank Margaret for coming up with a great idea and for you guys just taking that and making it the best it could be. And so, I mean, for me, this was the highlight of Trek Lit last year, I think, waiting for this to happen because it was so hyped. Like, we knew what's the fall going to be, what's going to happen, you know, and to finally get to the end and be so pleased with a series. That's really exciting. And I think it's a great time to be a Star Trek Lit fan because of that. So
thank you. I think part of the appeal to me for the series was that when we got to where we are at the end of the last book, you know, there are definitely some plot threads that still are require attention, particularly the DS9 story, Bashir's story in particular. You know, what's going to happen with the Titan? What's going to happen with the Aventine? And what's going to happen with Captain Sisko and the Robinson? And now Picard has a new set of orders and a new direction. And that was kind of what excited me about it, was that we were gonna lay out all these different avenues for the different crews to go on. And then, I mean, we're still going to have the big stories will still show up eventually. I mean, we'll come back to some story that requires a big, you know, multi-author effort at some point. But I mean, that's not going to be you can't do it every year. And you can't make it every time, you know, every time this cycles back to the 24th century, we're going to have this big multi-book crossover thing. That's going to get old after a while. People are going to get tired of that. And how many times can you threaten the universe with violation?
Right.
You know? And how many times can you tell a I mean, how long can you carry the political thing before people start to get tired of that? And plus, the lines are so interconnected. And even though we try to write each book so that it can stand on its own, there's still a level of familiarity that I hate to say it's required, but if you obviously are reading all the other books, you're going to get more out of the larger story than if someone was just reading and, you know, picking and choosing books to read from a particular crew or something. So, you know, now that we're at this point and things don't necessarily have to weave in and around each other as much, you know, I think it'll give us an opportunity to tell some different stories, some fun stories. But, you know, the Typhon Pact is still out there. There's still a concern. You know, the Federation isn't quite back to where it was before the Borg invasion, but it's well on its way to recovery. But, you know, there's still these things that are out there that will definitely generate stories, but it doesn't have to be, you know, the focus of a giant miniseries every year.
And that's something that's, for me, it was really interesting was, you know, you were just talking about, you know, you had the threads that you kind of got a chance to sew up and those that you got to leave open. And definitely one of the big ones was the fact that like half the book of what David George starts off with in Revelation and Dust doesn't get touched. And so we're definitely waiting now for more continuation of Deep Space Nine and how that's going to play out with Sisko and the Robinson and where they're supposed to be going. So there's a huge question there. I love that is really left for the reader to be longing for, because I'm ready for Deep Space Nine to return. And like you said too, with Titan, what in the world's going to happen there now that Riker's an admiral? Will he find a way to get back on his ship? Which, you know, I hope he does. But at the same time, the guy makes a great admiral. So I'm actually torn between where I actually want to see him. And so what was that like for you? Were you enjoying kind of teasing those things that were going to come next and figuring out, too, okay, what exactly do we want to wrap up fully here in that kind of bow that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I specifically asked, you know, what do you want me to do with Picard and the Enterprise? Where are they supposed to be at the end of this book? And I talked about it with my editor, Margaret Clark, and, you know, I said I would really like to answer once and for all the question of whether he's going to retire or whether he's going to get promoted or whatever, you know. We've been dancing around this now for a few books, and it's time to put that matter to rest. People think we're trying to sync up with Star Trek Online, or we're trying to sync up with a comic book or whatever. And I was like, you know, let's answer the question once and for all. We've been teasing it long enough. People are going to start getting irritated with us if they aren't already. And as far as the other crews, like, you know, Riker and the Titan and Dax and the Aventine and Sisko and DS9 and all that, I was asked to leave certain things open so that they could be followed up on, you know, forthcoming books. So, you know, Bashir's story will be told, you know, or will be furthered in David Mack's book that's coming up this year. He's telling a book about Section 31 and Bashir, so that'll definitely push his story forward. And, of course, David George is going to be going back to the DS9 crew at some point. And I believe there's a Titan novella coming later this year.
Yeah, there is. And actually, I think that's
John Jackson Miller.
John Jackson Miller, yes, is going to be, yeah.
Right. And so, and as far as the Next Generation, you know, I said, let's set the direction, but, you know, I can leave it purposely vague as far as what they're going to do so that the next writer in line doesn't have their hands tied too badly. You know, I mean, we can point them in the direction, but let's leave the particulars up to whoever the next writer is going to be. And so that's what I tried to do with Peaceable Kingdoms was, you know, I'll point you down the road, but what's going to be at the, you know, down the street when you start walking is up to the next person. And I don't know who, you know, there's been talk about who the next writer will be. We'll find out here shortly, I think.
Yeah, I think what I was looking and I was seeing is that Una was going to be writing a TNG novel.
Cool. And then there's but I think it takes place fairly soon after Peaceable Kingdoms, okay. At least in the continuity. And in fact, I believe it's going to follow up on a thread because, you know, right now Crusher, the way I had it at the end of Peaceable Kingdoms, Crusher's on her way to DS9
yes.
to act as an interim chief medical officer until they can find a permanent replacement for Bashir. Now, whether she stays there or not remains to be seen, but I mean, given her family situation, I don't expect that she'll stay there very long.
right.
And plus I said it, you know, I kind of said it at the end of Peaceable Kingdoms that she'd be hooking up with the Enterprise at some point soon. So, but I think Una wants to tell a story with her at DS9 before I, you know, or whoever gets to pick him up again.
Oh, that's great. I like that.
So it'll be fun. I think David George is writing a story where she's going to be the CMO at DS9. So, you know, who knows?
More Crusher, the better, if you ask me.
Matthew loves his Beverly.
I do. I love Beverly. I love it when she gets something to do. So that was huge in this book. I thought, you know, Beverly has a major role. And so you talked a little bit that you kind of picked her character because, you know, she hasn't had really a major role in the books for a while. Talk about just what you were hoping to be able to accomplish with her and where you kind of wanted to see her go as a character.
Well, no, I just wanted to do something. I didn't, because of the way they had set up the storyline in the previous four books with Picard and the Enterprise basically being under constant surveillance by, you know, Ishan, his the people that follow him, you know, getting Picard and the Enterprise into a situation where they could do something, you know, really, really exciting and stuff was going to require some subterfuge. So I came up with the idea of sending Crusher off on this mission to a planet that once was under Cardassian rule during the occupation. And to do that, I actually went back into our backlist, and there was a short story that Kevin Dillmore and I wrote for the Next Generation anthology that came out back in 2007,
mm-hmm.
It's called
mm-hmm.
The Sky's the Limit. And we had a situation where we had introduced a backstory bit for her where she is friends with a Cardassian doctor.
Yeah.
They met during the war and became friends, and they correspond periodically. And so I brought that character back for this story.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me my in for the Cardassian and Bajoran angle to follow up. That gave me a somewhat familiar character to go with. So she was the natural choice to team up with that Cardassian doctor and send off to this planet. So that's what got all this role. And, of course, I partnered her with a couple of the, you know, lower decks crew from the Enterprise to give her some. And then of course, we brought in Tom Riker again.
Right.
To give us the extra bit of fun.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, cool. I love his use in this series. He has become, I think, such a great character on his own in the novels, and I love the way that he's used in this series. I love how he's not Will, but in some ways he still has a lot of that Riker in him that we know, and I just love the twist. When he showed up, I was kind of cheering silently because I was at work reading. And so I was really excited to see
your boss
back.
Isn't listening to this.
That's right. Well, I was on break. I only get to read on break, but I was still at my desk and I wanted to cheer out loud. I was like, Tom Riker, yes, he's back.
You'll get to work, Matthew. Your boss will say, you know, I was listening to the latest literary treks and I've installed a camera across from your desk now.
Yeah. You know, those, Kindle online, you're not supposed to be reading online when you're at work. Oh goodness. Yeah, that was really great. And the other character too, that I really enjoyed, you know, we haven't seen a lot of, Chen in a while. And I've kind of missed her being a part of the Enterprise crew in a bigger way. And I really love the way that you wrote her relationship with the Picard and the way that she's matured into a character. Because she reminds me a little bit of Dax. She's just kind of snarky and she's funny. She has great wit, but she can be really serious and a character to be reckoned with. And so I was glad to see her back. Did you have a good time writing her?
I really enjoyed writing her the first time I got a chance to write for her was with my Typhon Pack novel a couple years ago. And I always liked her character from the beginning. I mean, when I was writing this one, I had to take into account, you know, it's been in continuity. It's been almost 3 years since the last time I wrote her. So she's obviously had time to mature a little bit and to get a little more seasoned and become more comfortable on the Enterprise. And Picard has had time to, you know, trust her and become more comfortable with her. But I like the dynamic between Picard's rather, even though Picard has mellowed a bit, you know, particularly in the novels, he's definitely not the same character he was when we first met him. You know, he's still very proper, very, aloof in certain ways and, you know, very, very structured, very, you know, very much the poster boy Starfleet officer. And then we have Chen, younger, more eccentric's not the right word, but unconventional Starfleet officer. And I just love the way that they can play off each other because he's, you know, he likes her. He sees a little bit of himself as a younger person in her and sees the potential she carries if she has the right mentor, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's where I was going with that. It's not a perfect comparison, but the closest comparison I came up with when I was writing her this time around was, I don't know if you follow a show called NCIS, but it's the military criminal investigators.
Yes.
You know,
Mark Harmon,
veteran
agent. And he has a relationship with the forensic tech who's very unconventional. She's actually rather goth and, you know, very much outside the mainstream compared to him. But yet, those two get along famously. You know, he basically treats her like a daughter. So there's something, like I said, it's not a perfect analogy or a perfect comparison, but that's kind of what I was going for writing those two together, was that, you know, he looks out for her, he mentors her, but yet he sees that she works differently than he's used to, so he's going to let her do her thing because she's professional when it counts.
Right, exactly. When I felt that same way too, with the way that you were able to really shore up and not shore up, but I think deepen that relationship that Worf and Picard are having on the Enterprise and really cement the fact that he's, I mean, it almost makes me forget in some ways that Riker was number one, before Worf was. That line when, Picard says to Worf, you know, I forgot how much I enjoyed having you around, Mr. Worf. And Worf snarks back, you know, that I thought you'd almost forgotten, Captain. And it's just what a great interplay between those two characters who have really mellowed and grown over the series in the novels. And those two, I think, mesh so well. And it was great to see that. So, yeah, I love the fact that Worf has really morphed into standout character.
Well, I mean, we remember that in continuity, the four characters that are left of the original cast on the Enterprise, you know, Picard, Crusher, Geordi, and Worf, you know, they've been together for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, in the Star Trek timeline, so. You know, there's going to be that intimate, you know, that familiarity and just, you know, intrinsic trust and comfort level between these four people. and particularly, and you know, a captain and his first officer are going to have that relationship anyway, just from working so closely day to day. And I was always fascinated by the idea that Worf would be the first officer to replace Riker. And of course, everybody's got, you know, everybody's, there's that line in DS9 where Sisko tells Worf, you know, that you'll never be captain because of what you did here. And I've always kind of taken that to mean, you know, it's a personal opinion of his. It can be, it's not necessarily prophecy. And I think Worf has done more than enough to redeem himself, you know, since that day. And, you know, in my mind, Picard telling Starfleet, I want Worf as my first officer, should be all the vouching or you know, support that Worf should ever need when the time comes to select him as a captain or to appoint him as a captain. You know, if the captain of the Federation flagship stands there and says, that's the guy I want as my number one, and he's the guy that's going to take over if something happens to me, that should be all the, you know, that should be all the requirements or qualifications or whatever that any naysayer would need. So that's kind of my personal thing with Worf and Picard is, I mean, I can see him captaining a ship one day. I don't know if it'll be the Enterprise or not, but, you know, I think he's more than earned. I think he's more than redeemed himself since the days of the, you know, when he was on the DS9 series and that incident. So
definitely. Yeah. No, I think so too. I think that the way that the books have really grown him has been a great response to that episode and kind of answering the question why he should be allowed to be a captain one day. And he's more than proven that I think that he's earned his stripes. What a dynamic character from somebody that, you know, just got told no all the time on the show.
Well, I mean, at this point in the novel continuity, with all that's happened and the role that Picard has played in all of these things that have taken place, you know, I really can't imagine the conversation where the person on the other side of the table is going to disagree with his recommendation.
Right.
I mean, just Picard. I don't want to, you know, Picard's not he's not infallible and he's not, you know, all powerful. But I mean, I think he's earned, you know, a couple of these markers to call in if he needs to. And now that we've shaken things up, I think that will. I don't know. Like I said, I don't know. I expect that the we'll try to keep the Enterprise E crew, you know, stable at least for one more book. And then, you know, it seemed like we changed them around a lot. From book to book, I think we've tried to stabilize them over the last couple of books, but it'd be nice if we could have a couple of books in a row where we didn't have to worry about major cast changes.
No, that's something that, too, that I was just thinking about, and it's something hopefully you get to talk to Margaret about, but, you know, with the casts, how hard it is, you know, you want to have movement, but you also, you know, like, so if you're going to have a Deep Space Nine book series continue, you know, you kind of want and expect somehow for Sisko to be a part of that, but, you know, he's on the Robinson. How does that all work with the Titan now, you know, with Riker? How does that work, you know? And Picard and his crew seem to be the only one that, you know, really right now are cemented and together. And so that's nice. It's nice to have one stable ship in the fleet.
Well, that, you know, there are a number of faces on the Enterprise crew that we really don't know a lot about. I mean, we delved in a little bit here and there and around the edges, and as we need to, we flesh out a little bit of this person's backstory or whatever. But I mean, now that some of this other stuff has kind of moved off the board, and I'm hoping that the next couple of stories will be a little bit more character, have some more character focus, not necessarily be character focused stories, but allow for more character focus. We'll start to learn some more about some of these new characters that have been introduced to replace folks who moved on. And you know, there have been folks who said, well, we don't know any of these people. Why should I care about them? I'm like, well, you didn't know any of them when the show started and you came to care about them. So that's our job, is to make you care about the characters.
Right.
So that's what we're supposed to do. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, I think that for me, you know, the authors have really done that. You know, especially say in the Deep Space Nine relaunch series, you know, a row for me was just a character that had been in the Next Generation. I didn't have a lot of, you know, love or hate for her. She was just a character that had shown up and a few times. And then you brought her into the novels and put her on Deep Space Nine and really created a character that I have fallen in love with, you know. So, and then there's been some other characters, you know, like watching Jasmine or die in Worf's arms. I mean, character that was just created for the books, and you know, it's heartbreaking. So You guys, I think, do a great job of carrying on the characters we know, but then creating characters that are brand new, but I end up loving, and then they die, and then I'm sad. So,
and we have to, strike a realistic balance. I mean, we can't remove too many familiar faces, otherwise it's not really a tie-in book anymore.
Right.
It's something else. And there are still fans who expect to see, you know, Picard on the Enterprise, or Kirk on the Enterprise, or, you know, whatever. And so we have to find a way to strike that balance to give them something of the familiar, but yet try to balance it with something new and unexpected. It's a tough road to hoe, especially nowadays where we don't really have another movie waiting in the wings to, you know, keep us in check.
Right.
And so there's always that risk that we go too far afield, but I think our editors and the folks at CBS licensing do a very good job of keeping us, they don't rein us in so much, but they do, you know, it still has to be recognized as a Star Trek story.
Yep.
And so there are certain parameters that you have to abide by and things like that, but I don't really consider them restrictions. They're just, you know, hey, you know, it's not my sandbox. I'm allowed to play in it for a while, and they're letting me do a lot of things. If we still had shows on the air and movies coming out with these characters every couple of years, there's no way we could do any of what we're doing.
Right.
Oh yeah.
And so it's an enormous amount of freedom that carries with it an enormous amount of responsibility, and we get a lot of support from the folks at CBS. And, you know, obviously there are things that we can't do, like I'm not going to marry off Worf and Picard or whatever. But I have that story in an outline form if anybody wants to read it.
fan fiction.
I've got my slash fiction folder here on my laptop. But so it's a lot of fun to be able to do these things. I mean, it's no other than Star Wars, I think. I don't know that other tie-in properties enjoy the level of freedom that Star Trek currently has in terms of the tie-in books.
Well,
so it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think Star Trek is the only one, because now that Disney has bought Star Wars, the books have taken a very different turn, and that whole universe is up in smoke right now. We have no idea what they're going to do with everything that's happened in their EU. And what's going to be considered canon, what's going to matter, and all that kind of stuff. So for them, that whole universe, that's kind of hard. Whereas in Star Trek, you know, did the best you could to stay in continuity with the movies and everything.
Well, I mean,
but it,
yeah,
you know.
It's a different approach. I mean, right. Star Wars is trying – and I read those articles, and I'm not reading as much doom and gloom into it as some people are. I think what they're trying to do is my understanding is it's more of an internal thing with the couple of folks that have been appointed into those roles and the team they're putting together. I think they're just trying to get a handle on all these various tie-in products. And they're trying to, when they say they're creating a canon, I think it's more of a, just an internal reference guide of some sort to let them, you know, to keep them ordered as far as how future tie-in works will be developed. I honestly can't believe that they're going to tell whoever the director is of the next Star Wars movie that he can't do what he's doing because somebody wrote a comic book years ago. You know, it's not going to happen. It never happened.
Yeah, right.
But I can see where they would like to. If, you know, they've already had. You know, Star Wars already had a level of consistency that they observed between the different, not just the different tie-in books, but between the different tie-in platforms. So, like comic books, and games, and novels, all shared something of a similar continuity. But you know, there's no way that a multi-million-dollar film director is going to look back at, you know, a Clone Wars comic book and go, "Oh, I can't do my movie because some guy wrote a comic book about
it." Exactly.
It's not, Now, as far as Star Trek, it's not like they don't know what we're doing. CBS is absolutely aware of everything we're doing, and they get to you know, agree or disagree or decline or, you know, whatever, refuse or whatever. But, you know, again, they give us a lot of latitude, and they support us. You know, that's not to say we haven't had ideas shot down. We have, you know, but at this point with the relationships, as long as they've been in place, you know, there's a level of trust and understanding, and almost we almost share a same brain in some regards about what, you know, we understand what they expect. They know what we're going to try to do. They can anticipate certain things, and we can anticipate what they would like and not like. So, you know, we're not going to send them something we know they're going to shoot down, you know. But then when I say that, it's not like the rules are so restrictive that we can't do anything. You know, they're like I said, they're very supportive and they'll listen. And then they'll say, you know, that might be too far off the rail.
Right.
And then we'll come back a little bit, you know. But it's interesting talking to the licensing folks and our editors to develop, especially these big plot lines that cover multiple books and, you know, unfold over several months and things like that.
Well, I think that really is the thing that's been so much fun about the 24th century is that now you guys do have this kind of free reign to be able to do so many of these big things that you couldn't do if we were still getting movies and TV shows and whatnot. And it's created a lot of fun. And for me, it really, in some ways it almost makes it mean more because it's right now it's not going to be rewritten anytime soon because somebody wanted to do something else on the TV show.
Well, you never know. Or we might decide just to reboot the whole thing, you know, we'll 52 the whole novel line at one point. But so, and I've joked about that once. I said, let's just hit the reset button and start all over. And I get dirty looks. But I mean, you know, yeah, we've got a lot of freedom, but again, you know, it's a responsibility we try to take seriously in terms of what we've been entrusted with. And just the same way, like the same way that the folks who developed the scenarios over for Star Trek Online, you know, mm-hmm. they are even further in the future than we are in terms of the timeline. And, you know, so there's almost nothing known about the period in which the game is set other than what they have developed as the backstory for their game. And, you know, they take that job very seriously too. Because I talked to some of the developers and the folks who write some of the storylines that come out of that, you know, that they develop for the game. And, you know, they're very serious about it. They understand that they've been given quite a prize in terms of the types of work that we do for tie-ins. You know, not everybody gets to do this kind of thing.
Definitely. And,
so it's a lot of it's kind of like, you know, with great power comes with great responsibility. You know, you can almost hear Stan Lee saying that in the corner. So you don't want to screw it up. You know, it's like, yeah, we could kill off character X if we wanted to, and there'd be no repercussions because there's no movie coming. But, you know, to do that, you have to have a really compelling story reason in my mind.
Yeah.
To do something like that, you know, when you're talking about a character that's beloved, you know, by any number of people, it's like, you know, you just don't do that because you can. There has to be a reason for it, and it should mean something when it happens, and it should have repercussions and after effects that are felt for books to come, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's something that I think, you know, we talked about a little bit earlier in this idea, you know, Picard was going to be kind of a big focus for the end of this book and kind of setting him off and answering some of those questions. And, you know, he gets to save the galaxy again, which was pretty awesome. I was kind of waiting for him to have his Star Trek VI moment, like Kirk, you know, in front of the council and give a big speech about, you know, where the Federation was going to head. But just talk a little bit about, you know, for you, his growth in the series and where you were trying to place him. We talked a little bit about that, but there's a lot that happens with him in here, I think. And I really enjoyed kind of getting to be that. Mostly for me, this was a great Picard and on the other side, Crusher novel. So just talk a little bit about kind of getting to set him off on his new course.
Well, I kind of picked up some threads that I had started back when I wrote the Typhon Pack book. You know, when I wrote the Typhon Pack book, he was a relatively new father.
Oh yes,
and I got kind of thrown into the deep end on that one. Mm-hmm. By the time I got to write the story that focuses on him, you know, his kid is a year old now. I mean, we you know, all that other stuff, you know, the rest of it had already passed. So I'm at this point where he's the captain of the flagship in a post disaster Federation. He's got this enormous responsibility, but yet he also has this other enormous responsibility as a father. And, you know, it begs the, you know, as a father myself, I was a relatively new father at the time I was writing that book. You know, I can understand the conversations he would be having with his wife and with himself, you know, about what's the future going to be. Can I continue on this course and yet still give my child the attention that he deserves, you know? And for a guy like Picard, that's a pretty big conversation to have with anybody. Mm-hmm. So that was where I started that in Paths of Disharmony, where he starts to ponder a career change. Is he going to retire? Is he going to take a post, you know, on a planet or, you know, go to Starfleet Command or something? And I left it open-ended because we honestly did not know where this was going to lead, you know, in terms of future books. So I left those questions unanswered, and, you know, when we circle back around, it's a couple years later, and here we are with another Picard story, and I'm like, well, we're still here with the same questions, and things aren't even, you know, they're not a lot better than they were when I left them in terms of the situation for the Federation. You know, I mean, there's that line in Insurrection that always keeps coming up when we have these discussions about the types of stories that are in these post-Nemesis novels. Like, does anybody remember when we were explorers?
Right.
You know, right. And Picard is an explorer. That's why he joined Starfleet. He wanted to go out and see what's there. And he understands he has a duty. He understands he has an obligation, you know, to for Federation security and that. But what drives him is the search for what's next, what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was losing that, and that's how I started to write him. Was like, you know, he's had to put that aside these past several years for all these other demands, and you know, I kind of see the ending of the Fall was like, okay, we're at a moment where he can make that, he can have that conversation and finally reach a decision. So that's why he has the meeting he has with Akkar and Riker at the end of the book. You know, it's like, look, I'll answer the call when you call, but this is not what I signed up for. And if this is what we're going to do, you know, if we're going to allow the politics of fear to drive us, if we're going to define ourselves by how we prepare for war, you know, that's not what I joined Starfleet for. That's not what Starfleet was when I joined up. I would rather go do something else. And so, obviously, we have a new president and a new, you know, a new administration and a new outlook.
Mm-hmm.
It was time to kind of restore something that Starfleet I thought had lost for a few books, or you know, for these past several years with all these crises that kept coming up. It's like, okay, we've kind of lost something here. So that's what Picard has been pining for. It's like, if I can't find it here, I'll go find it elsewhere. I think I owe that to my child.
Right.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, he's going to answer, you know, if they call him because there's a war on or something, he's obviously going to come. You know, he'll always serve, but given a choice between being a soldier or being an explorer, he'd rather be an explorer. So that's where we decided to take that.
Yeah.
It was time for a change.
Yeah, I loved that he does get that conversation, and I really liked that, you know, Riker and Carr have been expecting it too. They know that it's coming, and I love that they're smart enough to realize you keep Picard where he is. You let the man do what he does best.
Exactly. Yeah, and I thought about having the big speech in front of people where he says, you know, something like that to that effect. You know, we've lost something of ourselves, and it's time to go get it. You know, I get it back. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, that's really not Picard.
Mm-hmm.
Picard is not a grandiose chest thumper guy who stands up in front of hundreds of people and yells, you know, to the rafters, this is what we're going to do. That's not Picard. It never was. He's more intimate. He's more personal. He's more one-on-one, you know. So to me, that was the more appropriate way to take that conversation between two trusted friends. Yeah, and just so happens that, you know, somebody was already anticipating this is what he's going to say, and they had a set of orders ready for him.
Yeah.
So, it's amazing what can happen when you write the book, you know. Yeah. But that was my one request, and you know, as far as can we put Picard in a position where he can explore something. I'm not saying he won't get into trouble, you know, that's what happens in Star Trek books. You go out and do something normal and it turns to crap. You know, that's something goes horribly wrong. That's what happens in Star Trek books. So you know, he'll find trouble to get in, but the notion that we have to define ourselves by being ready on a war footing all the time, you know, that's not Star Trek.
Well, and I love that Akar's like, are you going to quote Kirk to me again?
that was my tip of the hat to Bill Eisner, yes. My good friend Bill Eisner. I love that conversation at the end of Losing the Peace, and I just love the way he wrote that. And I was hoping for a chance to call back to it at some point.
Yeah, and it's nice. It's great, you know, because you know, I think that one of the things for me that was one of the few things that I really enjoyed about Generations was that conversation. I think that was kind of what I expected the whole movie to be more like with those two together. But a really meaningful conversation. And I think one of the things that all of the captains in Star Trek have really shared in some ways with with Kirk is that idea that they're out there to make a difference, and that's what they do best.
It's funny you say that, because that's probably my favorite part of Generations, is that little brief conversation between the two of them where Kirk tells him that.
Yep.
Because to me, and this is just my own internal explanation for that, to me it explains the difference in Picard that we see between Generations and First Contact.
Yep.
You know, where he becomes a much more lead from the front, go into the, you know, run at the front of the away team or the front of the group that fights the Borg. That's he's more action Picard in the subsequent movies than he is in Generations.
Yeah.
And to me, that's kind of a way of, that's Kirk's, you know, advice to him kind of taking root. You know, that's his way of, it's one of the ways in which he takes Kirk's advice to heart.
That's a good connection.
So that's how I've always justified it. And I've always loved that line and when Bill Eisner did it in Losing the Peace, I said, you know, at some point down the road, I hope I get to refer to this because it's just a perfect conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was one of those scenes too, where, you know, Shatner just, there's nobody else who could deliver it like he did. And you know, the guy was Kirk, and you just bought that was the heart of who that man was. And it's the thing that kind of bound those two guys together, as different as they are. They still had that same core at the heart. And so, and I think that leads me kind of in the next thing. You know, for me, this book was really about this issue that had arisen, I think, in the Federation after so much had happened to it, that there was this idea that the end justified the means. And Shan really is the quintessential believer in that. And his whole philosophy is kind of built around that. You know, there's a whole point in the book where he's talking in his brain about, you know, will I have to destroy the Enterprise? Am I going to have to get rid of a car? Am I going to have to get rid of Riker? Who am I going to have to get rid of to make this come about, what I see needs to happen? And it seemed like this whole series was really kind of getting the 24th century back on kind of more of that classic sensibility, in terms of kind of the feel and philosophy that Star Trek has always had. And I felt like by the end of the book that really has kind of happened in some ways. Like it's still going to be a struggle, but they're kind of back where, you know, they were, as Akar says. You know, does it remind you of about 20 years ago, Picard? You know, I felt like this whole series was kind of doing that, as you kind of said, wrapping it up in a bow and kind of putting us back, at least philosophically, where Star Trek has always kind of been.
I mean, we're not done. Like I said before, we're not done with the Typhon Pact. We're not done with these other issues that are still on the table. And, you know, there's always the possibility of some other threat that we've never seen before coming along. But, you know, there has to be a balance in my mind, you know,
right,
to make it a Star Trek story. Otherwise, it's just a military science fiction story, you know. And I think that's obviously Picard is the prism through which we view all this. But, you know, he understands his obligations, he understands his duty, but yet that's not what calls to him.
Right.
And so that's basically Star Trek in a nutshell, as far as this balance between, you know, what we have these necessary things that we must be prepared for, but that can't define us as a group, as an organization, as an ideology. And Picard is the perfect representation of what we should strive for, you know, with what the Federation should be striving for. He's made his mistakes, don't get me wrong. You know, we know from reading the Trek Lit and some of the other things that have happened that he's made mistakes, and there are things that will haunt him, but yet, you know, there's still time to do the right. There's still a chance at getting things put back on the right course, and I don't know that redemption is the right word, but, you know, at least going back to the principles that we're supposed to be holding ourselves to.
Well, now that the fall is done, tell us a little bit, you know, you have your Seekers book coming out in September, and then tell us what else might be coming up for you in the Star Trek universe and then elsewhere.
Well, right now my world is all about Star Trek Seekers, which, have we talked about that before? I forget.
I think we talked a little bit about it before, because we talked about it with David Mack.
I think we talked about it with you, Dayton, last time you were on too, a little bit. It was just kind of starting to get going.
I can't remember how far along we were, but
yeah.
I mean, I guess for those of you who may not know, Star Trek Seekers is a spinoff series kind of a sequel series to a novel series that we wrapped a couple years ago, Star Trek Vanguard. We ended that story, and we pitched an idea a year or two ago to our editor about taking the two of the ships that were assigned to the station in that storyline, the Endeavor, which is basically a sister ship to the Enterprise, and a smaller scout ship, the Sagittarius, and spinning them out into their own series. And the idea was that even though it's one series with an umbrella title called Seekers, the books would alternate in even odd fashion. David Mack would write the books that focus on the Sagittarius and its crew, and Kevin Dillmore and I are going to write the books that focus on the Endeavor and its crew. And the first two books in the series tell a joint story to kind of kick things off, like a two-hour season premiere kind of thing, or two-hour mm-hmm. series premiere, and or so a two-book series premiere. And then after that, the intention is for Dave to write Seekers Book 3, which would be an individual standalone Sagittarius tale, you know, that carries forth the character arcs and things that he's starting out for his crew. And then we would pick up with Book 4. We would tell an Endeavor tale that would do the same thing. You know, the stories will largely be standalone in terms of the big plots, but we will start laying out character arcs that will pick up and, you know, in pursuit to varying degrees from book to book. And then, of course, the premise allows us to revisit, you know, the team-up once in a while, where we bring both ships together for a joint story or whatever we need to do, or team up with another ship or whatever. So it's a lot of fun. It's definitely, it's set in the TOS era toward the end of the Enterprise's 5-year mission, you know, during the original show. So we're starting to advance toward that period between the end of the series and that period just before Star Trek, the motion picture. So that's largely an undefined gap in the Star Trek history. So, should be a lot of fun. We'll see.
Yeah. It's a nice concept. I like that they're standalone stories, but also fill in that time period.
Yeah, that's really cool, and I'm really excited about the series.
Well, you know, we're going to proceed at a slow pace. We'll, you know, we'll let the stories dictate how fast we move along. But you know, it's back in that area of space that is away from what the Enterprise was doing, so we're not going to tread on its toes too much. But you know, we've got some ideas for bringing in familiar characters from time to time. But people keep asking us if we're going to bring in Vanguard characters and stuff. And you know, aside from the characters that were established in Vanguard for these two crews, don't know what we're going to do. You never know. I mean, we like to think that Vanguard's story is told, and we would like to leave it alone, not go back to that well too often. But, you know, you never know. Whatever, something might come up in a brainstorming session where, you know, hey, character X is the perfect fit for the story.
Right.
You never know. But don't count on, at least, and definitely don't count on these first two books.
So, for you, working on Seekers, anything else that... that people should know about that's coming out from Dayton soon that we need to be aware of? And two, where does everybody need to find you online and can follow you?
Let's see. The most, I think, the next thing I've got that'll come out is actually I have an essay that's in a collection of essays about Star Trek comics called New Worlds and New Civilizations, Exploring Star Trek Comics.
Oh, cool.
And it's put out by a group called the Sequart research organization, and they do these collections of essays about different pop culture topics. And so the focus of this book is Star Trek comics through the years, basically starting from the Gold Key group in the 60s up through the current IDW run, and just about everything in between, including little niche things like newspaper comic strips and the British comic strips and things like that. So I wrote a story. My essay focuses on the second run of comics under Marvel's regime, which came out in the mid to late 1990s, you know, that had 5 monthly series and various specials and crossovers and things.
Mm, cool.
And then after that, it's Seekers in the summer. And I have contracts on my desk right now as I speak for what my next project will be, but I can't say a thing about it.
Ooh, man.
I know, I hate
exciting.
That, huh? I
hate another secret Dayton project.
Yeah, another secret project. So maybe sometime around show 61 or 62.
Yeah.
But... and then, in fact, just today, I pitched a novel idea to my editor at Pocket, a Star Trek novel idea that I have no idea if it will go anywhere, but I was sitting in the doctor's office waiting room waiting to go in, and this idea occurred to me, and I kind of wrote up a short email and fired it to her, and then we had a back and forth for about, you know, 4 or 5 different back and forths where we talked about how it could work. So I don't know if that will ever go anywhere, but I've been thinking about it all day, and it's kind of driving me nuts, so I'll probably have to write some things down before I can get back to work on Seekers.
Well, I will tell listeners, Dayton, I guess this is your 4th or 5th time maybe on the shows on the network, if you listen to Dayton shows in order, you'll always hear at the end of a show the secret project. And then if you go to the next show, you'll usually find out what that secret project was.
So, yeah, so just, you know, keep coming back to me once in a while. Hey, are you ready to talk about it yet? And we'll do the big reveal.
Right.
But, yeah, I just got the contracts yesterday. I have printed them out so that I can read them over and sign them and send them back. And then once the contracts are signed, that's usually when I'm given the green light to talk about what it's going to be. So Cool. Maybe in a couple of weeks.
Excellent. Well, that's a really exciting. I love, we loved from History Shadow. And I was so glad to see you get to finish off the fall. I'm looking forward to the Seekers. And so every time you do this to me, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting to see what Dayton's going to be, you know, giving us next. So big secret project. I'm looking forward to that. And I just really wanted to say thank you for coming on. It's great to have you on for our 47th episode of Literary Treks, which is always a big deal. To get to that point, big Star Trek number. And
absolutely.
So we really appreciate your support of the show from the very beginning, and can't wait to have you on again. So thanks for being with us.
No, thank you for having me. And back at you guys. We appreciate the support you give us by having us on, talking about our work, letting people know where to find us, and letting people go find us on our bookstores and all that. It's we appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
All right. Thanks for having me on, guys. Take care.
All right, Matthew. Well, it was great to have Dayton on again. I'm glad that he could be on for our 47th show, because he did help us kick things off with the very first episode of Literary Treks. Of course, he's been back with us a few times since then. But, 47, the magic number, and closing out the fall as well. Just, it was yet another great interview.
Yeah, I love getting to have Dayton on just because of that. It is a great milestone for us to have reached, and it was a lot of fun that it just worked out that we had him on now. And man, it's crazy to think that the fall is over now. And
I know, right?
But as we talked about it in news, I'm really excited that we're going to be continuing as we get into this new year with having Voyager. And so we'll stay in the 24th century for just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. We had such a build up to the fall. We talked about, the little clues that were coming out for so long, and it was such a build up, and to think that it's already all five books are already out is hard to believe, but it is here. So, well, I hope everyone enjoyed the interviews, of course, today with Dayton, but all the interviews that we've had with all the authors of the fall. But of course, the fall isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM over the past week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
A piece of the action commentary.
Wouldn't that be amazing if you went to a solar system and Spock was like, okay, Kirk, you're not going to believe this, but I'm pretty sure there's a Death Star here.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could just go to a Death Star, you know?
And he'd be like, no, there isn't. Holy cow, there is. Oh my God, that's awesome.
Earl Grey.
TNG Season 1 Recap.
And we get to see some junior officers that Lieutenant LaForge is now in command of.
Instant pep talk and miss I don't know what button to push.
That's what happens when you leave the entire senior crew off.
The Ready Room.
Affliction and Divergence.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about that, though, is to compare the Klingon ethics with the Section 31 ethics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, there are some groups within the Klingons who maybe don't feel exactly the same way. But then there's this group within the humans who feels completely different. You kind of wonder what the Klingons think maybe about someone who wouldn't do this.
The Orb.
Implications of genetic enhancement.
Miles slowly kind of gets to know these other characters. He's a little bit more comfortable with him, but he's still kind of at arm's length because they don't have that normal sense of control, what we would call normal sense of control, that Julian does.
To the journey!
The Borg.
Some people might really get on my case for saying this, but I think the Borg were bigger baddies and more threatening and more scary in TNG than they ever were on Voyager.
Warp 5.
Enterprise Season 3 with Larry Nemechek.
All of a sudden, UPN got put under Les Moonves, the head honcho of CBS, the master TV network dealmaker, and kind of looked at this thing, and he was not all caught up in the goldenness of the 90s and the aughts, and he's like, you guys aren't paying your own way.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Alphas.
Those TV shows were nerds. And nerds liked those TV shows because, like, of what they were. And Alphas was actually a pretty cool nerd. And people didn't seem to like it because it was just a little bit too tough looking. Like, yeah. It maybe knows how to throw a football.
Literary Treks.
Slings and arrows, the oppressor's wrong.
And I'm curious to see, the next time I go back and watch Homefront Paradise Lost, how much this adds to the experience for me, knowing all this stuff that was going on and knowing how much more involved Layton's plans were than what we knew about just from the episodes.
Matter Stream.
Star Trek Axanar with Alec Peters and Richard Hatch.
If you've ever experienced war or any kind of conflict where everything is life and death, there's a certain kind of resolve, truth, experience that you come to that I don't think too many people can understand or ever really empathize with.
And introducing our newest show, Melodic Treks, covering the music of Star Trek.
Alexander Courage and the TOS theme.
Rodden B, in fact, wrote words for Courage's Star Trek theme song, not because he expected the lyrics to be sung on television or anything like that, but just so that by doing, he could claim credit as the song's co-creator, and therefore receive half the royalties from the song.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download and stream from the website. So check out your favorite show and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And if you'd like to share your thoughts on the fall or anything else we've been talking about, there are several ways you can do that. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show and all the topics that we discuss here, and really anything about Star Trek that you'd like to discuss. You'll find it all over there on the forums. In social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll find us on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek, under username TrekFM. All right, Matthew, well, now that the fall is over and you're not busy, you know, trying to flesh out the crew of your new Andorian cruiser, the Matt Russ, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, people can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, just tweeting about all sorts of different things. And then, of course, we also do another show together called The Orb, where we talk about Deep Space Nine. And so if you enjoy Deep Space Nine, you'll want to find us there. And then I do have my own personal blog. So if you're just interested in things that I write that don't always have to do with Star Trek, you know, movie reviews, book reviews that aren't Star Trek, things like that, you can find me at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not hopelessly following the fanfic for Kathy and Coco online, where can we find you?
You'll find me corresponding with the monkey, kind of like Data did, you know, in Pen Pal, sending letters back and forth. You know, we're planning and plotting the next installment in that fanfic, but when I'm not doing that, you can find me on Twitter, and my username is C Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, of course, besides doing The Orb with you, Matthew, you'll also find me on The Ready Room every week, where I'm joined by guests from all around the network, as well as other special guests, as we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series and Star Trek news. You'll find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise, and I have my own interview show, Matter Stream, where I talk to actors and writers and scientists and all sorts of people about topics that are either loosely related to Star Trek or inspired by Star Trek. So check out all of those shows as well if you're interested. And lastly, before we let you go, we'd also like to ask you once again to support our sponsor for this week's show, and that is audible.com. you can go over to audibletrial.com/trekfm to get a free audiobook of your choice. It could be The Physics of Star Trek, which we talked about in the news segment today, or any other book that you'd like, Star Trek or otherwise. They have over 150,000 titles for you to choose from, and they add hundreds of titles every week. So go over there to audibletrial.com/trekfm. Get your free trial. If you choose not to stay with Audible after the trial, you still get to keep that free audiobook, so there's nothing to lose. And you'll be helping us bring literary treks to you every week. And also, one more thing you can do is go to trek.fm/donate if you'd like to make a contribution to the network. We have alien badges and art prints there for you to choose from. They're original illustrations by Tobu Uji, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. You can mix and match, choose which format you want them in. We have different levels of contributions that you can choose from as well. And your donations help us pay for the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you every week. So we really thank you for helping us keep the network going.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for the last 47 episodes. And until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.